everybody, and welcome back to the IBS Freedom Podcast. Today, we are going to be discussing methane. Am I right, Amy Hollenkamp, co-host yes. extraordinaire?
Yes, ma'am. Kind of like you're right.
Mixed it up a little bit there.
Whoa, look out.
I know. BTW, my name's Nikki, since I forget to introduce myself 99% of the time. Let's get right into it. So I'm going to do my usual and kick it off to you for starters. So tell the dear listeners a little bit about methane, if you would.
I will. I want to say first that I'm glad you're taking over the intro duties. That one episode where I had to take over intro and closing, I just feel like it's harder than it looks to intro well. So I want to give you props for being such a great intro woman.
Introer.
Yes. So I think the interesting thing to me about methane, and you can tell me what you've experienced or heard from a methane standpoint.
Oh, I'm sure I will.
I think this is something that started maybe earlier on in the SIBO space, like maybe, because that's when I was coming on the scene, and I had methane SIBO.
Okay.
So when I was coming on the scene, everyone was talking about how like hydrogen was easier to treat than methane. And I find that that's something that's still prevalent. I hear that from people like, oh, I have methane. It's a little bit harder to treat. Is that something you hear?
I think that that's a common belief. I have not found it to be clinically true at all.
Right.
And now I think it might be taking a little bit of a backseat because now it's like the new methane is hydrogen sulfide. So now people are like, well, I have hydrogen sulfide and it's really hard to treat. It's like, actually, again, I would beg to differ. No, it's not. And no, you don't have to do like the full-blown Alison Seebecker, like 6 capsules of oregano 3 times a day for the rest of your life. Like, I'm exaggerating, but still.
Right.
I don't find methane that crazy hard to work with necessarily.
Right. Like, I don't find it any different than other forms of SIBO.
I think, honestly, it's probably a throwback to the conventional medical world, because if you think about it, in conventional medicine, you get diagnosed with SIBO, and then it's like knee-jerk reflex, and they go, oh, okay, rifaximin, bada-bing, bada-boom, you're cured. And the thing is that very rarely is the case for methane. So I think that's why there's like this belief that methane is harder to treat, because the quick one-and-done 10 days of Xifaxan, where, like, sometimes that will work for hydrogen, that almost never works for methane. But it's like you're taking an antibiotic for something that's not even a bacteria. So, of course, you need to target it differently, right?
Like,
of course, the antibiotic for hydrogen overgrowth SIBO isn't going to work on methane. Like, why would we expect that it would do that? It's not that it's hard to treat. It's just you were treating it inappropriately.
And I think that's such a good point. And I do feel as though like now it's being labeled differently, like not methane SIBO. It's being labeled IMO or an intestinal methanogen overgrowth. Am I saying that right?
Yeah, methanogen.
Okay. Overgrowth. And I mean, I think the nuance there is that they're saying, oh, it's not a bacteria. And it doesn't necessarily have to be in the small intestines is the main kind of change that they're making to the current paradigm is that, you know, it doesn't have to be in the small intestines. Methane can very easily be overgrown in the large intestines as well. So I think that that's a new finding. It'll be interesting how that changes things or if that changes much in terms of how people are going about treating it. Have you found that there's been any change in how, or what you've heard have people changed their approach with this new IMO classification or not? Is it just kind of a big like, oh, here, this new name, and then it's like, meow, 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 meow.
No, well, I think that not the people who come to work with me, certainly.
Right.
I mean, I'm having that conversation with them. I've been saying for a while, like, it doesn't, like, all right, if you have overgrowth in the small intestine, no matter what it is, I'm thinking we've got to promote motility, make sure you don't have a mad leaky gut. Like, there's certain things like support the MMC. Like there's certain things that you do when there's small intestinal involvement, but you know, otherwise methane is methane is methane. Like I treat small bowel overgrowth of methanogens virtually the same as I do colonic overgrowth of methane, because you're still going after the same thing.
It's just,
it's like you add in extra motility support if it's in the small bowel versus if it's in the colon, then maybe that's a little bit of a different story and you don't have to work quite as aggressively on motility. But yeah, I mean, I don't know. I think if people are starting to change their tune, I have not met many of those people as of yet coming into
Yeah. And I haven't really seen even the main practitioners that are fairly SIBO famous changing their thinking around it, or it hasn't really changed how they're approaching methane in general.
What's funny, actually, is that I forget what podcast this is. It might have been like the SIBO Doctor podcast or something. Somebody who's a clinician in the SIBO space, I forget who it was, but I think it might have been on a podcast. I just remember, like, it was within the last year or two, the person was bringing up this idea of like methane SIBO versus EMO, right? Of small or SIMO, as small intestinal microbial or methanogenic overgrowth. And she made this kind of funny point about it that rubbed me the wrong way, because it was more like, I think she was saying, like, if your practitioner calls it methane SIBO, then you need to get a new practitioner. And I think it was more of just like a big ego boost for whoever this was. I wish I remembered who it was. Not that I would say their name anyway. But it was just, it was a very like, if they don't know the proper terminology that it's EMO, then like, go elsewhere and get yourself a new practitioner. It's like, I don't know, screw you a little bit. Like, we don't need to get ultra nuancy about it. Like, I guarantee you that most of the GI doctors who are diagnosing methane SIBO are still calling it methane SIBO. Like, and they know that it's an archaea that's producing the methane. Like, they don't actually care. All they're going to do differently anyway is they're going to give you rifaximin plus neomycin, or what is it, metronidazole. They're just going to mix up the prescriptions they give you instead of just giving you rifaximin, but they don't really care what it's called. Like, why are you, person on a podcast, getting all bent out of shape about it? I mean, like, I like to say things correctly, so I try to.
Like, it doesn't change. It doesn't change anything. I think, again, like, it's interesting because methane's also going to slow down motility. So there's always usually going to be a constipation predominant issue in people that have methane. Have you ever seen it not be more diarrhea predominant, or?
I feel like I have. I can't think of individual patients right now, but I feel like I have, because I know I've had the conversation with people at least once or twice where people were like, yeah, isn't this supposed to be the constipation variety? And we're like, yeah. So yeah, every now and then you get that. Here's the thing too, though. It could be, run with me on this and I'll play devil's advocate. Like, yes, it could be true that methane SIBO, quote unquote, I'm just going to call it that. It could be true that sometimes methane SIBO presents as diarrhea rather than constipation, or it could be that you have two different things going on, and you have methane SIBO, and you also have, I don't even know, like, insert like
dysbiosis
diagnosis here.
And
dysbiosis
in the
Crohn's.
Large intestines.
Yeah, like, you know, insert any number of things. I just got a stool test back today on somebody who, to the best of our knowledge, doesn't have like a raging case of SIBO. We hypothesize maybe a touch. But I just got a stool test back from a patient today from LabCorp that she has one of the funky strains of E. coli. I think it was like enteropathogenic E. coli, I think. Blatant infection. So I forget what my point in telling you that was, honestly. I think there might have been a point.
The point is that you can still have diarrhea because other factors the ecology of the gut could be promoting diarrhea. While you might have methane IMO or methane issues in the small intestines.
I think that's, honestly, I feel like that's more likely than saying, oh, that methane causes constipation like 95% of the time, and then 5% of the time you're just a weirdo. Like, I have a hard time believing that. I think that it's probably that that is not what's causing your diarrhea and you need to hunt a little bit more. Like maybe you have candida. Maybe you have,
right.
I mean, again, like insert any number of pathogenesis here. But yes, typically methane is thought to cause constipation. And what's interesting too is that from what I've understood so far, when you look at like a SIBO breath test, for example, and you see hydrogen, you could look at somebody who has a peak of hydrogen, say like 40 parts per million, and then another person who has like 80 parts per million, and right. then another person who has 8 million parts per million. And it doesn't necessarily correlate with the degree of symptoms.
Right.
Right. Like I've seen this studied at least a bit where like hydrogen, like the more hydrogen you produce doesn't necessarily correlate with the degree of diarrhea or bloating or pain that you have.
Right.
But methane does seem to track well with the degree of constipation. So the right. person who has 10 parts per million methane overproduction is probably going to be somewhat constipated versus the person who has 20 or 40 or 1,000 or whatever. Like the more methane you have or the more methanogen overgrowth that you have, probably that's going to track with more severe constipation from what I've seen, at least.
Right. Right. So, yeah. Such an interesting point. And I agree. I think that hydrogen can be definitely a more finicky gas. It might not correlate with symptoms, but you're totally right. It seems like the severity of symptoms go up with the breath test result yeah. for methane.
Which again, like it makes me think twofold. If more methane equals more constipation, from what we can tell, then again, it really makes me think that the people who have diarrhea methane problems, like I'm thinking that the diarrhea is caused by something else and the methane right. should be causing constipation. Like when you see a linear tracking
right.
like that of data points, like you could be reasonably certain that it's going to be really causing that thing. Like it's really right. causing constipation. So A, it makes me think that that idea that like some people get diarrhea from methane SIBO is probably not true. And it also right. makes me think maybe the hydrogen overproduction, maybe the SIBO itself isn't the problem that's always causing
right.
the pain or the bloating or the whatever in the people who have hydrogen-based SIBO. Like, again, it might not be the overgrowth, guys. It might just be that you have wicked small bowel dysbiosis and that it's the degree of the dysbiosis that is tracking with your symptoms rather than the degree of the overproduction or the overgrowth. So,
right.
my two cents.
Yeah. And I often wonder too, like in some capacity, methane producers and hydrogen sulfide producers compete for hydrogen. Mm-hmm. This again might be a little bit down the road, but I often wonder too, like a lot of SIBO diets cut out things that maybe hydrogen sulfide producers eat.
Mm-hmm.
So like higher sulfur things like cruciferous vegetables, those types of foods. Like mm-hmm. I wonder in certain scenarios if feeding hydrogen sulfide producers can help bring methane producers down. Into balance. And it's mm-hmm. kind of wild to think about that because you know, you have people on these SIBO diets or low sulfur diets or, you know, lower. So I would say most SIBO diets are typically, well, I wouldn't say that because a lot of them are still higher protein, but there could be factors that are bringing hydrogen sulfide producers down
yeah.
With some of the dietary interventions by cutting out higher sulfur foods.
Yeah. Well, and here's an interesting point too. So I get, I have Google Scholar alerts programmed for a couple of cases. Like I have one programmed for SIBO.
Right.
And I actually just saw a brand new article, March 31st, 2021. It was actually wow. posted today. And it's titled, I think it's actually in another language because it's in brackets. But the title I'm seeing is The Diagnostic Value of Hydrogen Sulfide Breath Test for Small Intestinal Bacterial Overgrowth. But what's interesting, and this is not the episode to talk about hydrogen sulfide, but just for what it's worth, I thought this was interesting. Because if you listen to any of the big names, Seebecker, Pimentel, if you listen to any conversation about hydrogen sulfide, there's been a couple of themes, but one of them is that hydrogen sulfide seems to produce either diarrhea or mixed IBS presentation,
yeah.
not constipation. But interestingly, here in this study where they looked at 300 subjects, 84 men, 216 women, and they did lactulose breath tests, and they said the conclusion of the paper. Let's see. Hydrogen sulfide breath test consistent with, lactose hydrogen methane breath test, especially in constipation predominant patients, may provide a reference for the diagnosis of SIBO. But they actually were noting in here that hydrogen sulfide tended to cause more constipation from their findings, which is kind of crazy because that's the first time I've really seen that discussed.
Right.
Again, like any of the experts I've ever heard talk about hydrogen sulfide specifically have said, oh, hydrogen sulfide, diarrhea or mixed presentation.
Right.
And that may not be the case. I think it might depend on the location. It might depend on the person.
Right.
Depend on the organism. There's multiple organisms that make hydrogen sulfide. But I thought that was kind of interesting and hopefully useful. So we'll have to do a whole episode, maybe even two, about hydrogen sulfide because that's a whole other beast to tackle.
But, right.
Redirecting. Back to methane. So methane is the gas. It's the formula for it is CH4. Right. Mm-hmm. So it's a carbon and four hydrogen molecules. So what's happening is that methane and hydrogen sulfide are both part of what's called a cross-feeding relationship in the gut microbiome. So one organism will make hydrogen, and then another organism, like these methanogens, will gobble up the hydrogen, and it will take two of those H2 molecules, slap it on a carbon, and now you have CH4 and you have methane. And then similarly with hydrogen sulfide, you're taking two of those hydrogens, slapping it on a sulfur, and then boom, you have hydrogen sulfide. So really, methane, a couple points to make is that sometimes you need to address both the bacteria that are making the hydrogen gas in addition to the methanogens that are making the methane gas.
Right.
It's not that you want to be completely without methane. Like, I know I've heard Jason Hawrelak, the probiotic advisor guy, talk about the fact that if you go in and you just eradicate the methanogens completely, the people end up having more severe bloating because you no longer have the methanogens taking these big, spacious molecules of hydrogen gas. Those methanogens are actually taking that gas and they're compacting it down to methane to something that takes up less space, interestingly enough. So
yeah.
Your microbes might actually be making methane to protect you from more pain and bloating because they're trying to compact the gas and keep it more manageable for you. And it's all just part of a cross-feeding relationship. It's probably that the methane is then going to be consumed by another bacteria or another organism, and we just don't know that yet. But it's all this like really intricate web. So to think that you could go in and just like pinpoint one bad thing and nuke it and be done with it, it's like, well, you might have more symptoms because of that. And you might be ruining a whole cross-feeding relationship that was actually really important for something that we just have yet to understand completely.
Right.
So I wanted to make mention of that.
Right. It's like your microbiome can adapt. Microbiome could adapt to the scenario that's presenting itself. And I think understanding that your gut is an ecosystem, and I think we all often talk about how you can't, it's so hard to demonize and target one thing without realizing the collateral damage that can happen everywhere else. And that's really I think one of our goals is to help people think about it in a different way. And I think sometimes with a lot of the testing that's being done, it's very easy to be like, oh, this methane is the number one bad thing that I need to focus all my energy on. And again, if you get a breath test with high methane, it's probably something to address. But is it the only thing going on? You have to look so much deeper at function, like what you're talking about, motility. You gotta look at, digestive capacity, permeability, how the immune system's functioning. You have to look at all these different factors. And it really comes down to looking at the ecosystem as a whole versus really trying to isolate one thing to attack without considering some of the collateral that could happen. And sometimes, like, doing something is going to have a little bit of collateral, but if the benefits, if the risks kind of are not outweighing the benefits, that's kind of what we have to juggle, I think, with the microbiome, because there's so much intricacy to it. And I think what you're saying too, like, we don't understand all the ins and outs of it. Right. Yeah. And I think we're trying to learn as much as possible. But one thing that I've learned just in general working with people and with, through my own journey, is that respecting the intricacies, and that we don't know everything, and that there might be stuff that we don't understand, and we do have to listen to, like, intuition and what our bodies are telling us too, and not get so kind of down the road of killing and that sort of stuff if it's not working. But yeah, that was kind of a long tangent just to say we gotta respect the microbiome, or whatever I said before.
I think it was microbum.
Okay, microbum.
Because I remember thinking it was like a combination of microphone and bum.
Okay.
So I'm gonna remember that now. So yeah, you have to respect the microbum.
Yes.
You know, like, and that's
the microbum.
Honestly, like, it comes down to some degree of, like, mental flexibility and humility.
Right.
On the part of the patient, as well as the doctor or the nutritionist or whoever you're working with. Because, like, I'm sorry, if I go to any doctor or any professional, anybody, and they think that they are, like, God's gift to medicine, and that they have all the answers, and that, like, they 100% are going to cure me of whatever, I'm like, like, I don't know if we're going to really jive. And I don't know, like, those are the people where I wonder, like, is your ego going to get in the way of what we're doing? Like, are you willing to learn? Are you willing to think outside the box? So honestly, those people kind of freak me out, as opposed to somebody who, and maybe, like, I might swing too hard the other way. Like, I'm always having these conversations with people where I'm like, hey, like, here's what this test tells us. Here's what it doesn't tell us. Here are other factors we might not even be able to test for, but we know that they could play a role. And I'm trying to really, like, zoom out and see the whole thing. But I mean, I read, so I forget where it was, but I read somewhere moderately recently that about 50% of the bacteria that live in the gut microbiome, we don't even have a name for yet.
Yeah.
And if we don't have a name for it, you can sure as heck know that we know nothing about them. Like, step one, when you study a thing, step one, you observe that there is a thing. Step two, you name the thing. Step three, you try to understand the thing. So if we haven't even named the damn things yet, we don't know anything about it. It could be that there is, like, some amazing, amazing bacteria that makes us, like, some life juice that we don't even know yet. And we're not going to discover it for another 20 years. Like, science is not done yet. That's the beauty of the human experience. That's the beauty of being in, like, a medical field or a scientific field, is, like, science is never done. We could always discover something new. I mean, what was it? Like, 3 years ago, they just discovered that the brain has a lymphatic system? What?
Right.
Since when? Like, that's crazy. But meanwhile, and, like, they're still discovering, like, immune cells that we did not know were there 10 years ago. And yeah, so sure as heck, like, we don't know everything about the microbiome. And once we identify the name of the bacteria and try to assess if it's a good or a bad thing, we don't know all of the compounds that these bacteria are making. We don't know all of the compounds that they're consuming. And again, you can kind of picture, like, this big web of interactions where, like, this probiotic makes, it's kind of analogous to the human experience, Amy. Look at this. Joe works at a pizza shop and makes pizza for a living, but maybe Joe doesn't want to eat pizza. But then Amy goes to his pizza shop and eats the pizza. But then Amy is like, oh, my husband Armand wants Skittles for dinner. Sorry, Armand, I'm going to throw you under the bus. So I'm going to make a big plate of Skittles for Armand for dinner, being the loving wife that you are. Obviously, you would do this. And then Armand is like, oh, I'm going to plant some carrots in my garden so I can feed Chip the most beautiful organic carrots in the world. And then I don't even know where it goes from here, because now I'm talking about a dog, people. But, like, it's like that, like one bacteria makes a compound and then one bacteria will eat that thing, then it makes another compound, and it keeps going on and on and on, and we have no freaking idea. So, I mean, yeah, try to measure the methane, sure. Try to measure the thyroid hormones or whatever else could be causing constipation, because I'll tell you too, methane's not the only thing that causes constipation.
Right.
And I have seen cases where people were dead sure that it was the methane causing their constipation, and it turned out it was something else. But, you know, I think methane can be worthy of treatment, but I wouldn't hyper-focus on it or anything else for that matter. Just kind of keep your wits about you. But that brings me to the point, what are your favorite tools for reducing methane?
Yeah, I think, again, I think herbals can be beneficial. Again, there's different ones that are sort of like more specific for methane. I find that even with, like, I actually like Dysbiocide and FC-Cytal. Sometimes I'll throw in, maybe in certain cases, like an Allicin or something like that, just for a little bit of extra, but not always. So it just depends. Those are probably the main ones. Sometimes I know that there's like atrantil. I've experimented with that a little bit. How do you feel about atrantil? I'd be curious to...
Extremely hit and miss.
That's exactly what I've experienced with it.
It's like, it's either that you will take it and you will think it's like this miraculous, wonderful thing, or you will take it and it will do precisely nothing for you.
Yeah.
I've not met a single person who's like, yeah, I took a Trontil and it helped like a little bit. Like, I've never heard that before. It's always like, oh, the angels sing, or no, it didn't work for me. And I haven't parsed out what the percentages are with regards to that, but it doesn't seem, I think more often than not, it seems to do nothing. I would guesstimate we're looking at like 70-30 or 60-40, somewhere in that range. Yeah. Like 60-70% of the time, it seems to do nothing. And, you know, 30-40% of the time, people are singing the praises and thinking it's the greatest thing ever. It can be worth a try. But yeah, I think there's better ways to go about lowering methane.
Go ahead.
No, you.
No, I was just going to say, too, like, also thinking about strategies to keep things moving as you're addressing methane as well, I think can be helpful.
Yeah.
If you're doing a lot of clearing and things aren't moving properly, that's going to potentially cause some problems as well. So really trying to make sure that you're doing things that are going to help assist the movement of whatever you're clearing out of the system, because when you're already predisposed to constipation, I think could be beneficial. And usually clearing out the methane should help with that in general. Like, there's this like balancing act with that too. But trying to make sure things are moving properly. And I think that's almost with most clearing as well. Like, if things are getting backed up, but I think with methane specifically, doing some things to assist with motility, to make sure that you're able to detox and poop stuff out as you're killing things.
Well, or even just to be really basic about the thought process, even like if you're taking a probiotic or a prebiotic or an antimicrobial, you want that thing to reach the place where you're hoping it's going to go.
Right.
Like, you don't want it to get in there and then meet a wall of poop and then just hang out in, you know, the first part of your colon or whatever. Like, you want it to move all the way through your body and not be hindered by that wall of poop. So you really got to keep it moving through your system. And actually, that's a really good point that you brought up. Sometimes Band-Aids are really wonderful. And that could mean natural or pharmaceutical, potentially. But, like, I have had patients where I'm like, all right, look. And I remember one lady, and it's a shame, she stopped working with me, but I remember we had this disconnect and I didn't ever quite get on the same page with her again. But I remember in our last appointment together, she brought up again, she said, you know, when my constipation gets bad, that's when all my other SIBO symptoms get really bad. Like, it seems like the backing up for a couple of days or whatever it might be really sets off the constipation. And then it's like, oh, after a couple days of being constipated, then I get really wicked bloating and whatever else her symptoms were. This was several years ago. So I think I was going to have her start on a probiotic that's been shown to be beneficial for constipation. And also, I think I was going to have her start on like a natural laxative like aloe or something to that effect. And she got really pissed at me. Like, I got an angry email. And she basically said, like, that I was just band-aiding stuff and that I didn't listen to her and that there was nothing in the protocol that was going to be treating her SIBO. And I was like, I'm so confused. Like, we just talked about this. Because the constipation and the backing up is triggering the SIBO stuff. Right. So we need to get ahead of the constipation first. Like, and yes, we are going to treat the SIBO, but it was such a heartbreak because I was like, no, like, I had a reason to give you these things, right. Please. And I was almost in a position where I was like, even if you hate me and you never want to work with me again, please buy these two things and get these on board because I really think they'll help you. Right. And I don't know if she ever did, but like sometimes you just need to keep the poop train going. Right. And if that means that you're taking like aloe or natural calm magnesium or, you know, some over-the-counter something, like you've got to keep pooping. Otherwise, all of the lovely things that you're taking orally for the methane or the constipation, it's never going to get where you want it to go. And even I know one practitioner in the functional space a couple years ago turned me on to this. A nice high dose of vitamin C can go a long, long way of clearing things out in a very vigorous manner. So I have a whole protocol written up for my patients where I'll guide them through this and I tell them what to expect. But I'm like, you do this on a weekend when you have absolutely no plans because you will be pooping a lot. Like once the vitamin C hits you, it's going to hit you. But I actually have some patients every so often do a vitamin C flush where they get it all out. And that way, when we start on the antimicrobials or we start on the probiotics or whatever it might be, it's kind of like a colonoscopy prep in a way.
Yeah.
But you know, you've got to clear the runway so that things can start to take effect. And that could be really particularly beneficial for the methane where you're in this catch 22 of like the constipation and the stagnation are going to make the methane build up worse, but then the methane makes the constipation worse. And you've just got to like get something in there to take effect. And then you can build off of that progress. So for what it's worth, that could go a really long way too.
Yeah, and I think you're exactly right about Band-Aids. Like, you don't want to only be Band-Aiding things.
Correct.
But you can Band-Aid things to help push other things that might be more root causal forward and to help you actually address other areas that are root causal. So I totally am in full agreement with that. I think that sometimes people... And I know we were Marco Poloing about this. I mean, same thing. You could go into like supporting thyroid if your thyroid's low, like support,
thyroid's
you know, like
a huge one.
Right. Like, again, it's if that's creating constipation issues, like whether there's Hashimoto's present, which a lot of times there is, even if it's not, like taking that for a period of time. I know you said your husband at one point was taking it kind of as a Band-Aid for a period of time, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Like out of the blue in grad school, he had a TSH of like 5-ish. And we were like, huh, that's weird. And he was on levothyroxine for like a couple of months while I was tinkering with stuff in the background. And then he was able to get right off of it. So it wasn't a big deal. But yeah, I've had a shocking amount of patients come to see me with Hashimoto's or hypothyroidism or something. And we get their labs back and their TSH is high, like, I mean, some of these people like 8, 9, 10, 11, 12 for a TSH, which is absurdly high. And they're like, no, I don't want to take medicine. I don't believe in medicine. And I'm like, like as a person who had way too many antibiotics in my lifetime, and I look back and I wish that some doctor like talked to my parents about, we need to be careful how many antibiotics we give your child. As somebody who's been on the other side of that, I appreciate it. Yet, if your body is blatantly hypothyroid, you're going to be just always inflamed and your metabolism is always going to be slow and your hormones are going to be dysfunctional. Like you can't heal leaky gut or make your motility work if you don't have thyroid hormone. Like it really might be that you need to take thyroid hormone for a couple of months or a year or two, or maybe forever, while you work on the underlying root causes, but like, don't punish yourself and make yourself go without the medicine that you need just because you want to be this natural hippy dippy person. Like, yeah. I'll confess again, like, do as I say, not as I do. 2 years ago, I had the sinus infection from hell. Just like, it was a month, 30 days of this thing just not going away. And I was getting really creative. I have a whole drawer of sinus sprays, Amy. I don't know if you know this about me. I have a whole drawer of sinus sprays and a neti pot and weird shit that you put in a neti pot. I even got a probiotic that is specific for the nose. I was buying kimchi. I was doing all the things and nothing was touching this blasted sinus infection. And I had it for 30 days. And my ear, nose, throat doctor finally gave me a jug about this big of liquid steroids and told me, he gave me instructions. He called it waterboarding, I think. And he was like, so here's what you do. He's like, you go home, you take this, you like put a funnel in your nostril. I kid you not. And you pour, like you have to hang your head off the edge of the bed. And then you have like your husband or somebody pour the steroids in your nose, fill up your nose, and you try to hold it in your face for as long as you can. It's going to be like 3 seconds, but you try to hold that liquid in and keep your nostrils and your sinuses completely full of this liquid for as long as you can before you vigorously expel it from your body. And that'll break the inflammatory cycle. And I was like, no, 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 no.
Oh my gosh.
I don't want to do this. But I also didn't want to take antibiotics. So I was like, oh my God, what is the lesser of the evils? And I looked at that giant jug of steroids. I was like, I'm not doing this. I'm not doing this. And then it occurred to me, why would I fill my nose with steroids, with a liquid steroid like that, when you could go to CVS by Flonase, which by the way is a steroid. You could buy Flonase over the counter. I kid you not, it was the best day of my life. I got Flonase for the first time in like a decade and a half, and I felt really yucky about it because it wasn't natural. But I got the Flonase, I went home, I did a squirt up each nostril, and I did like one squirt in each nostril for like 3 days in conjunction with the probiotics and the nasal sprays and all the schmears that I was doing. Side infection was gone.
Oh my gosh.
Like, really? Like, and all I had to do was go buy a bottle of damn Flonase and suck it up and do the thing that was not natural. And actually, I just am recovering from a sinus infection again right now. And this time I got ahead of it where I was like, all right, I gave myself the whole weekend and Monday. And then I was like, all right, screw it. I'm doing Flonase. And it's basically almost gone. But I had to decrease the inflammation to a point where I could get ahead of it enough that my hippy dippy shit was able to work. But I could have let myself suffer potentially for weeks or months with this sinus infection just because I didn't want to do the natural thing. And like, I appreciate that. Obviously I do, because I've done this to myself before. But like, if you need something as a Band-Aid, don't feel shame in needing a Band-Aid, you know?
Yeah.
Total tangent.
I'm also going to lower my desk. I'm getting tired of standing. I'm at a standing desk, by the way. Did you know that?
I did not know that, no. I'm firmly planted on my bum.
Look at me. My desk is sinking.
Oh. That was funny. Yeah, for those of you not on video, you missed out.
The yeah, my
audio
desk.
People.
Oh, man. Well, yeah. This feels a lot better.
Oh, good. Take a load off. Stay a while.
Yes. Well, that feels better on my leg.
Let's see, though. Let's see. So, okay. So, methane. Going back to the conversation at hand of targeting methane. So yeah, I really like FC-cidal and dysbiocide as well. They're probably my two favorite combos that I use. I think that they're reasonably effective for both methane and hydrogen from what I've been able to tell. Not the be-all end-all, but I would say like 90% of people who I have try those products end up really liking them. You know, Allicin, occasionally I'll throw in there. Etrontil, you already mentioned. I really don't use Etrontil just because I haven't seen anything crazy from it. So I don't really use it much. I think, doesn't berberine supposedly do something with methane, maybe? I like berberine for a lot of other reasons. I don't remember, but I feel like berberine might be something that's been talked about for methane. But my actual favorites for methane tend to not be antimicrobial at all. My
prebiotics?
Well, one, yeah. So partially hydrolyzed guar gum.
Nice.
And I'm laughing at myself for saying this because those of you who know my YouTube stuff, yes, I'm gonna beat it to the punch. Yes, PHGG was one of my SIBO mistakes back in the day, but for a different reason. I actually use a lot of PHGG. I like it as a supplement. It's just, it made the SIBO mistakes list for a different reason, which we can talk about later. But PHGG does reduce methane really nicely, and it fluffs up the old poops. So
yeah.
I really like PHGG. The other thing I really love is BioGaia, the probiotic combo. It's like, God, I always forget. Hold on. It's like, it's two strains. I think it's the Reuteri, like DSM-17-something. I forget. But if you look up, it's literally just BioGaia Gastrus probiotic. It comes in a chewable, and there's a baby drop that has one of the strains in it. But one of those, or one dose of that probiotic once a day, usually can take back methane quite a few points. I think I've seen like 10 or 20 points for the probiotic alone.
Awesome.
And I've seen really profound shifts from just doing those two things and not even doing antimicrobials.
Yeah.
At all. Which is pretty fun.
Yeah, I think it's such a good point. I feel like it's very easy to jump on the herbal train because it's just the go-to that you hear in the popular protocols. But yeah, I agree. I mean, I think most of the time when I work with people, we're trying a few other things first and sort of seeing what happens. But I really like PHGG a lot. I'd be interested. I haven't used BioGaia a lot. I've had a few clients that really like it. It's something I would want to experiment a little bit more with. That's awesome.
Yeah, no, it's good. That's one of the better researched probiotics. I mean, not in line with like Culturelle. I think Culturelle has way more research on it. But yeah, they've done a lot of studies. I think it boosts the immune system in some way. Like, I think it might have been shown to decrease incidence or severity of upper respiratory infections, perhaps.
Cool.
It's been shown to be beneficial for constipation in humans. And I don't believe they measured methane or did anything with methane in that particular study, but it has been shown to decrease constipation and improve, you know, transit time. And also it's been shown to reduce methane. And I think it's actually been shown to help eradicate H. pylori.
Oh, nice.
Yeah. So it's actually one of my favorite tricks up the sleeve for H. pylori. And for the record, if you look at the ingredients of the chewables, I'm just going to answer this question before people even ask. The ingredients are, it has some sort of like maltodextrin or something in it. And I called the company and I spoke with somebody and I emailed with somebody and they were able to look it up. It's from non-GMO corn, not wheat. So it is gluten-free and celiac safe and all of that jazz. So don't sweat that.
Nice. Yeah,
it's a pretty fabulous little product and they're quite tasty.
Oh, nice. I love a tasty product. I love like inulin and FOS.
Yep,
I've got my
inulin
cotton
right
candy
on the shelf looking at me.
Remember?
You know what's funny? I told a patient that recently. So I was working with this boy. I think he might be 8, 9, 10, somewhere in that range. And when I have kids, especially, like, I'll usually have them taste something right here in the office. Because, like, I don't want to send them home with something they're not going to take. And one of the things that came up on his stool testing merited the conversation around inulin. And I had him take a little bit on a spoon. I was like, tell me if I'm crazy. But like, and I think the mom has listened to the podcast. So I was like, Amy and I swear that this tastes like cotton candy. And then he tried it. And he was like, yeah.
Yeah.
So we at least have one more vote for the cotton candy theory of inulin. But yeah, it's stinking delicious. And this kiddo was perfectly happy to take inulin.
Nice. Yeah. I find that I have a pretty high taste tolerance of things being bad and still being like, oh, I'm good. So like sometimes I'll have to warn people about certain things that don't taste as good. But yeah, I like the FOS scenario. But you're saying the BioGaia tastes pretty good.
Yeah, it's like, it looks weird when you look at the label because I think it's like mandarin orange flavor and some sort of mint. And you're like,
yeah,
orange and mint. But then you taste it and you're like, oh, okay.
It works.
Yeah, it does.
Nice. I had a question for you too on the topic of methane.
Yeah.
Because I've seen it come up with a few of my clients. Mm-hmm. I'd just be curious to hear your take on it.
Uh-huh.
It's on the use of HCl when there's methane. Have you heard have you heard any of the controversy around this?
I feel like I might have, and I'm rusty on it, so refresh my memory. Spill the tea, Amy.
So, Pimentel, and maybe this was, like, 2017, but I was looking before this call, like, he's repeated it a number of times, has said to not use HCl for methane.
Okay.
But the study, like, he says he studied this, but, like, again, I don't necessarily think it's a great, like, he's inferring different things. So he did a study where they used PPIs and they found that it lowered methane. Have you heard this?
Okay.
And so he's saying
PPIs
that,
for everybody!
Right, right, right. So then he was saying that the acid, like when you add betaine-HCl, it adds a hydrogen-rich acidic environment that's going to feed methane. Based on the study that PPIs lower methane, but like, I don't know. I think it's just a ridiculous...
I doubt it. I mean, all due respect to Pimentel, because I've been on many of his webinars, but I'm not buying it. For that matter, honestly, like I've seen betaine-HCl cure people of constipation.
Right. Just straight up
be like a miracle worker for constipation. So I find it hard to believe for one. Number two, again, like it's cross-feeding. So,
right. So maybe the hydrogen... Not... Go ahead. Sorry.
Well, yeah, these are not the organisms that are going to consume hydrogen for one. The other thing is that stomach acid, like... There's so much to parse out.
you need to just go, like, hear what he's saying, too. Like, I'll send you an article.
Yeah, do. I'll send you this new one I referenced, too, so you can look at that, the hydrogen sulfide one. My first thought is that the stomach and the small bowel are separated. Right? Like, there's a
sphincter.
So, yeah. Like, it just doesn't make any sense. Like,
right.
So does that mean that everybody who has a normal or adequate amount of stomach acid automatically has high methane? Or does that mean that everybody who has like gastric ulcers and genuinely hyperchlorhydria, does that mean that they all have methane? Because I have not found that to be true. Right? Like you would think that if that was the case, then we could follow this linearly. Also, there's a sphincter. Also, when the acidic bolus of food gets into the small bowel, it's met with a bunch of bicarbonate and juices and stuff.
Right. It makes me wonder, like, I mean, if you go down the rabbit hole of this theory that he's proposing that betaine-HCl could cause higher methane, makes me wonder in those situations, like, makes me wonder a little bit about, like, like what you're saying, the shutting off of the acidity in the small intestines, like if that was glitchy in maybe that you could maybe argue.
But that, even like the H2 molecule that we're talking about that then the methanogens consume is different than what is in the stomach. Like an acidic environment has a lot of free floating hydrogen ions. It's just H+. Versus two hydrogens bound together to make the gas. So it's actually totally different, like, it's a totally different thing.
I'm in total agreement with you.
My mind is again, a little boggled.
Well, it's interesting, too, because I had another... I brought it up because I had another... I wore that shirt in an Instagram post, you know? Mm-hmm. The higher... or more stomach acid, not less.
Yeah.
And an ND wrote under it or commented, like, except when there's methane, like methane. And then I remembered that, like, there was this thread, like, back a couple years ago talking about, but again, it never made sense to me, like, how that could be.
It.
Yeah, I'm not buying it either. I haven't seen it working with people that have constipation.
I mean, here's the thing too, like this would be tremendously easy to study. And Pimentel, you have a lab, we don't. study it and then get back to us. But like this hypothetical, like I'm not seeing the linkage there. And I will raise you one snarky point, by the way. You know what has a shit ton of hydrogen in it? Water.
Whoa.
Better not drink water either, or you're asking for trouble.
Oh my gosh.
So like, you know, where does it end? Like there's hydrogen. Yeah, I'm not buying it. This is my long way of saying I don't buy it. And again, I respect him tremendously. I've been on like every webinar the man has done in the last however many years. I don't know, except for this one apparently. But yeah, I'm not buying it.
Yeah, I agree wholeheartedly. I think he's doing some really cool stuff, but I've never understood that point. Yeah. And maybe again he could parcel it out more, but I just haven't seen it working with people that HCL doesn't help someone that has methane SIBO in certain scenarios. Like not everyone with methane SIBO needs HCL either, but I haven't seen it clinically.
I would argue too, you know, to a point where I've seen many people with constipation who got a heck of a lot better, if not cured outright from HCL. I have yet to see a single person who got more constipated because they took betaine HCL. And again, like if the severity of methane production tracks with the severity of constipation, you would think that if the hypothesis was true, that a lot of people would be saying that they got constipated when they started taking betaine HCL. And I have never, ever seen that ever.
Yeah.
And I've worked with a lot of people who have been on HCL. So yeah. I'm calling bullshit. I don't believe it. I think, you know, interesting. It's like a good thought experiment to chew on. Right. And it's like a good mental exercise. But I think that it's not anything I would put a lot of weight in.
Right. I agree. I was just curious your thoughts. I'm glad we're digging into some controversy.
We're spilling tea.
We're spilling tea.
Tea has hydrogen in it too, so you better watch out. Don't drink tea either. Shit. We're doomed.
Oh my gosh.
Now for the rest of your week, I'm going to be texting you like, you know what else has hydrogen in it? Air.
Yeah.
Chip has hydrogen in him. Oh, don't pet your dog. Like, I'm just going to come up with the snarkiest things for the rest of the week. But yeah, okay, so let's see. So we covered some herbals. We covered the cross-feeding thing, which I think is really big. The constipation thing. I'll just throw this out here, too. The ways that you could assess for methane are going to be either a breath test, right? So you could do a glucose or lactulose-based breath test and look for that SIMO, the small intestinal methanogenic overgrowth. And you can start to see the beginning of the colon overgrowth too, right? Like if you have methane overproduction after like the 60 or 90 minute mark, then we're starting to think that you have colonic methanogen overgrowth. And again, like you could still do PHGG, you could still do BioGaia, you could possibly incorporate some allicin or some of these antimicrobials on board. Really, again, it's just whether or not you need a lot of aggressive motility support really is the difference between the two, in my opinion. But the other thing is that you can see this sometimes pop up on stool testing. So I know that this is a part, what is it? The Genova GI Effects has the method of Brevetobacter smithii on it, and sometimes that'll show up positive. I don't really utilize that test. It's very expensive and not super good for what you get, in my opinion, although it has some redeeming qualities to it. The GI map I stopped using about a year ago, but to the best of my knowledge, the GI map has never had methanobrevetobacter on it. Have you seen a GI map as of recently? I don't think they've added that, correct?
I think they have methanogens.
Really?
I'm pretty sure they do. Let me look it up.
Maybe it is on there.
I feel like I've seen some recent ones. Let me just look up a couple. Okay.
Let's see.
I'm almost positive it does.
Okay. So maybe that's a more new addition, or maybe I'm just forgetting.
It has methanobacter. It has the family.
Oh, okay.
So it doesn't necessarily have.
Okay, close enough. Okay, so GI map maybe is able to look at that reasonably well. The way that I usually assess for it is just like a 16S based stool test, typically. So something like Thrive or, you know, Ubiome back in the day would have done this, or BiomeSite. But usually on those kinds of tests, like the 16S test, you want to see method of Brevetobacter showing up at like a 10th of a percent or less. Like, it should be a very minor part of the ecosystem. The yeah. highest number I've seen so far, I believe the woman had 7% methane. Yeah. Like, method of Brevetobacter show up on her 16S stool test.
Oh my gosh.
She was quite constipated. And all sorts of other not fun stuff going on. And she did really, really well on Herbal Prokinetics, PHGG, BioGaia, and maybe like a couple of other things here or there. But she did really well. And the next time we ran a stool test, her number was 7.77%. And then it went down to like less than a percent within the next
nice. That's
test.
Huge.
Yeah. So like you can put the kibosh on this little guy if you really need to. Like, she's a case where I was like, oh, we need to really clamp down on that. Usually yeah. if it's a little bit more subtle, I'm like, oh, we'll just kind of gently lower it. This woman, I was like, no, we need to really smack the crap out of it for a little while.
Right, right.
But I don't think we even did antimicrobials for very long, if at all. And we still yeah. got a really good improvement. Again, I think it was like 7.7% down to less than a percent within a couple of months.
Right. Such a good reminder that, you know, you don't necessarily need to go full on aggressive. Yeah. And I think most of the time when people find us, they've already done a lot of
yeah.
antimicrobials and,
yeah.
you know, rifaximin, neomycin. And like at some point, they've just like, I find a lot of times nothing's really working from a clearing standpoint because there's so much disarray. There's so much collateral yeah. damage from the clearing. So it's such a good reminder that, like, you know, aggressive isn't always better when it comes to the microbiome. And, mm-hmm. and that's the same to me. That's true with methane. Yeah. And I wonder too, bringing it back to like the first idea that we had, that I still think's like there. I think I've heard it less so, but like, oh, methane's harder to deal with mm-hmm. than hydrogen. Again, like that can maybe want you to go to more of the aggressive side of things, mm-hmm. but
yeah.
you're so right. I think a lot of the approaches that are more delicate in some ways can still be really powerful.
Huge. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, like I said, I don't think we did. Well, actually, hold on. Now I'm just really curious. Hold on. I'm going to pull up this woman's chart real quick because I can look at her chart and see what we did.
Well, and I think too, like one other point about the PHGG,
mm-hmm.
because like, and I know you were saying, like, oh, in the study about that, I'm curious to hear a little bit your take on it, because it's used to kind of, in the SIBO space, to feed the bacteria to make it easier to kill. That's mm-hmm. the mentality. Yeah. But, like, I think a lot more of the benefit that's seen in some of those studies has to do with actually supporting microbes that can keep methanogens in check.
Yeah.
You know, there's nothing of that in the research on it, no. but like, I almost think that that's more of the effect that you're seeing. It's like preserving some of the species and supporting some of the key species that can keep methane mm-hmm. in check
yeah.
while you're clearing it. It's not just this singular, oh, it's feeding bacteria and then making it easier to kill. I think that's a very like simplistic way to think about it.
Well, and PHGG feeds other bacteria too. So like PHGG,
right.
it feeds bifidobacterium to a certain extent. It feeds lactobacilli to a certain extent. And that was, to go back, that was my beef with PHGG when it was starting to become popular a few years ago. And that's why it was one of my SIBO mistakes back in the day, because it was, and it still is, completely unfathomable to me. That somebody would be like, I need to go on the low FODMAP diet and starve right, the SIBO. Right. And then, oh, I'm going to add PHGG so I feed the SIBO. It's like, why don't you eat a damn onion?
Like, right.
If you're trying to starve the SIBO and then you're trying to feed the SIBO all at the same time, you might as well eat the food that you want to eat and be done with it.
Like, right.
That's why I made it a SIBO mistake, was I was like, that's dumb and exhausting, right. and you're going to be nutrient deficient, and just like, eat the fiber, eat the food and get some diversity and some joy in your freaking life. And then if you want to take PHGG on top of that, that's fine. But, like, don't fool yourself into thinking, like, oh, I'm going to stay on a low FODMAP diet and then do PHGG. And that's just the same thing as eating. Like, no.
Anyway. Well, and I think you're right. Like, the benefit of PHGG has been attributed to, like, oh, it makes SIBO easier to kill. But, like,
I don't know if we know that.
Right. I don't think we know it at all. Like, that's a theory. But again, I often wonder and hypothesize that it has a lot more to do with supporting the actual environment in the gut than it being like this, like, feed to kill strategy.
I don't know if 100% you've ever been.
Okay.
Yeah. No, I think, same page. There's some extent we have to meet people where they're at, and that is the lingo in the SIBO space. And that's the belief in the SIBO space. So if somebody comes in and they're terrified to feed the SIBO, and then we could show them that one study and say, hey, feeding the SIBO, quote unquote, helps eradicate it. It's like, if that could be a bridge to get people to understand that they don't have to be on this super restricted diet forever and ever, and, like, there's another way to think about the SIBO, then great. But yeah, I don't think it's feeding the SIBO, actually. Because if you think about it, too, the bacteria that make up SIBO usually are E. coli and Klebsiella, supposedly. Mm-hmm. And I don't think I've ever seen anything that suggests that E. coli or Klebsiella eat PHGG. Again, PHGG feeds Bifidobacterium, Lactobacillus, probably some others that I'm forgetting right now, too. But it's probably that the PHGG is treating the dysbiosis, which is the real problem.
Right.
And it's not actually doing anything to your supposed overgrowth. And if you treat dysbiosis and you feed the damn good guys, of course it makes it easier to get rid of the bad guys. But I don't think it's like the E. coli is like hibernating and then you feed it some PHGG and the E. coli is like, ooh, great, chomp. Oh no, oregano. And then like you kill it more. Like, I don't think that's actually what's happening.
I really want to create like a play. We'll be in a play and then like we will act out these scenarios.
I am in favor of this.
Yes.
Yes. Done. We have so many great plans for when we get together in person. And what's fantastic about it, if you think about it, is we're going to need cameramen for this.
Oh my
god. That basically means Armand and Mike are going to be the camera people for all of our crazy adventures. And then I'm going to give all the footage to my assistant and be like, here, Carla.
Oh my gosh.
Edit that into a movie.
Yes.
Oh my god, I can't wait. But I can just picture the face on my husband, at least, when we're coming out. Like, I'm E. coli.
Right.
It's going to be wonderful. It's going to be, again,
I know.
We were discussing prior to the recording, people, that now that we have an Emmy award-winning performance on YouTube, our next, we have to get the whole EGOT. So any 30 Rock fans will know what I mean by that. But we're going to have to get, what is it, the Emmy, the Tony, the Grammy, and the Oscar. So we need to work on...
So this will be an Oscar, or Tony, because they're going to be plays.
Yeah, we have to work on the rest of the portfolio here, Amy, but we can do it. We will EGOT, and then we'll get blingy necklaces. Right. Like,
we're going to make like a play. Show. We're going to make a play to set everyone straight about guar gum and what it's actually doing.
I mean, it could be just SIBO broadly. I mean, I feel like we don't want to get, like, SIBO too broadly. Niche-y.
Okay.
Then again, I mean, there is a SpongeBob SquarePants Broadway play or musical, right? So I feel like the sky's the limit, really. Yeah, we'll kick around some ideas. Yeah, we'll figure it out. Don't you worry. But mark my words, people, we're gonna EGOT. But anyway, okay. So to go back to this lady, by the way, her method of Bifidobacter was 6.77%.
Oh my god!
And then 4 months later, 0.3%.
Whoa.
Yeah, pretty
crazy.
Rad. And like, I'm looking here. Okay, I had her do the prokinetic speed dating that I think I've mentioned before. I had her on an herbal tincture for like adrenal adaptogen type stuff. She had some other overgrowths and such, but it looked like at various points I had her on lauricidin and propolis. I don't always use those for methane though, so she must have had something else going on that I wanted to tackle in addition to the methane. And then PHGG and BioGaia and vitamin D. Yeah, I mean, nothing crazy. Like, the only antimicrobials that I'm seeing in her chart notes, honestly, are lauricidin and propolis. And it looks like we only did that for about a month. And neither of those are particularly aggressive doses either that I'm looking at. Really, the bulk of the changes we got look like it was probably from the PHGG and the BioGaia. So nice. It can be done.
Yes.
If we got hers back on planet Earth, then you can too. I think that's everything I have in my brain about methane. Just about. Yeah. Oh, actually, no, that's a lie. I have one more thing. Really quickly, hold on. As soon as I said those words, my brain was like, nope. But I remember I found an article that I talked about in FODMAP Freedom, and I've got to pull it up here. Okay. Yeah, so there is this. So the title of the article is Methanogens in Humans, : Potentially Beneficial or Harmful to Health. And it looks like it's a 2018 study. And they had this nice little schematic with a balance point, the tipping scale, where they say that there's actually been documented low abundance of methanogens in inflammatory bowel disease, IBS-D, so irritable bowel syndrome with diarrhea, and atherosclerosis, interestingly enough. So those people tend to have not enough methane production. And then there's a higher abundance typically documented in obesity, anorexia, which is really interesting. Who knows why that is? IBS-C, shocker, diverticulosis, and periodontitis. So it seems like, and the whole premise of the paper was, it's not good or bad. It's just a thing. And it needs to be balanced with the other things. But it appears that having too much or too little both can cause problems for you. So don't go in thinking, oh my God, methane is evil. We have to obliterate right. all methane. Because then you might right. wind up on the other side of the pendulum in this yeah. case.
So. I think that's kind of similar to a lot of the, well, might be a little slightly different, but makes me think of some of the stuff coming out on parasites. Like, mm-hmm. parasites are a whole nother animal that we're going to discuss, I'm sure, at some point. But, like,
oh, yeah.
a lot of parasites aren't necessarily good or bad. I mean, there's certainly ones that are bad.
Yeah.
But, like, some of the big ones that people tackle super aggressively,
yeah.
you're like, is that really, like, the problem? Yeah. To be going after, could it be totally fine in the context of a healthy gut?
Yeah.
And I think that's the same thing with methane. It's like really understanding the ecology and, mm-hmm. you know, is it something that needs to be focused in on?
Yeah.
And again, maybe supporting the ecology as a whole, like you can do with what you're saying, like BioGaia and PHGG can yeah. be helpful. For a lot of people, and then again, maybe some other people need a little bit more aggressive treatment, but this idea yeah. of jumping full aggressive might not be the best way to go.
Yeah, or trying all of the antimicrobials on planet Earth. Like, I'm sure that there's going to be some people who listen to this episode and they're like, okay, I'm going to buy lauricidin and propolis.
Right,
like,
right.
That's not the point. But there's going to be those people who are just looking for that shining silver bullet. And it's like, all right, well, good luck, because the silver bullet doesn't really exist, but I empathize with the people who are in that position because they're probably really burnt out and miserable and symptomatic and feeling right. like they're in quite the pickle if they're looking for the silver bullet. But yeah, I mean, it's honestly, the more I study the human body, the more I think that there is no good or bad. Everything is somewhere mm-hmm. in the middle. Even, I don't know, like even... I mean, I don't want to get too esoterical on us, but I think that there are signals from the body, and I think that there are states of imbalance, but there's probably no true good or bad. It's just a spectrum of, like, your body sending you signals and letting you know what it needs, and some of the things we're going to understand, and some of them we don't, because, again, science is not done, and that's okay. They never taught us in science class that science was done. Like, well, we right. know everything about everything, guys. Don't go into yeah. STEM fields.
They said, I remember science class, the scientific method. Do you have any experiments that you did, like, in grade school in particular, just out of curiosity?
I'm sure I did, but now I need an example from you.
Do you know what my science fair project was in, like, 7th or 8th grade? And my mom was, like, not seeing red flags.
Oh, God.
My science fair project was to see if, like, fire-resistant baby clothes... Do you know that there's the baby clothes that are, like, fire-resistant?
Uh-huh.
Like, if they actually burned or not. That was my legitimate experiment that I thought up in my head.
What was the result?
They burn! You should have seen me, like, with tongs, like, lighting these, like, little squares of baby clothes on fire. I'm sure my parents were like, oh my gosh, we don't
I
even know.
I picture you as such a strange child.
Like, I was a
baby clothes
child.
On fire and then going into the hair salon and just like and
well,
sniffing the hair salon.
I will say too, like, I feel like my parents, I was one of four, so in a pretty big family, and like, I'm sure my parents like passed by me like holding stretched out this like piece of baby clothes with like a flame underneath and we're like, oh, this looks weird, but we're not really gonna ask any questions and just kind of walk on. But yeah, that was ridiculous, but I do remember doing that. It might have even been like freshman year of high school, honestly. I'm trying to think exactly when that was, but I do know
it's
that
perfect.
That was like a major science experiment that I did.
That's pretty perfect. Truthfully, I was not the type. So I'm a very good student if I'm interested in something.
Right.
And I'm a very bad student if I'm not interested in something. So like every social studies class I have had in my entire life, hated it. Hated
yeah.
every moment. I would not study. I would barely pass. And it was like, I never did homework. It was just like a thing I had to do. Science, usually I was pretty keen on, but I'm also not like super good with imposed deadlines always. So
right.
like papers and science projects, like they always expected you to do it over the course of several weeks. But I was always the kid that like did the paper or the project like the night before. And
right.
I half-assed
Me
it
too.
Because I did not plan it at all. So I don't know. I don't remember any of my projects. I can tell you that I won the biggest pumpkin award. My third grade elementary school had a contest, and I had the biggest pumpkin in the entire yard and or the entire school. And would you like to know why I had the biggest pumpkin?
Why?
Because, Amy, I grew up on a farm, and we had the most brilliant way to grow pumpkins. You know what you do? Beginning
what?
Of the year, the growing season, you take your pumpkin seeds. And all you do is you go out behind the barn to the horse manure mountain that is behind your barn. And you just chuck the seeds into the manure. And you let nature and fate dictate the winnings for the year. And let me tell you, pumpkins love horse manure like you would not believe. I mean, honestly, all plants love manure, but those pumpkins were gigantic. We could not get the pumpkin in the trunk of the car. We had to like drive down the road with the trunk partway open.
Oh my gosh.
Because we couldn't get the pumpkin in the trunk. And I'm not going to brag, but like Cassavant Elementary School, this was probably like 1994 or something. I whooped ass. Nobody
this is a
had
big deal.
Any hope of coming
oh
near my
gosh.
Pumpkin. I'll have to find a picture because I know we still have pictures of it somewhere, and it was a behemoth of a thing.
Oh, I cannot wait.
Fresh
I have
from
to
the
see
new patch.
Did you tell everyone that when they ate some pumpkin pie with your pumpkin?
I think that we took it home and made it into, I'm sure we made like pumpkin pie or something. And yep, nobody cared. Nobody. But that's, you know, farm life for you. Everybody just knew, like, yeah, just wash it off. It's fine.
Oh my gosh.
Well,
yep.
I hope they washed it off. I'm not really sure.
Nah.
Yeah, probiotics.
We'll kill them.
Well, on that note, this is a 2-episode week, people. So we're going to hit the pause on the recording. And then this week, we are also uploading a Q&A episode. So if you haven't listened to that, stay tuned. Amy, I will see you momentarily for the Q&A episode. Toodaloo.